On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk about the beanball kerfuffle that has been going on in Southern California between the Dodgers and the Padres. The Braves sweep the Mets, making the already fascinating NL East even more compelling. We do the good, the bad, the ugly. I update you on what I saw in Omaha, and we look ahead to the weekend. That's it. That's the show. You don't even need to listen now, but you still should. Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that would never podcast intentionally at someone else. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and maybe the Padres and the Dodgers should just listen to the show.
Yeah, you know, we try and keep the peace, but every few times during the Major League Baseball season, we have some teams that think differently, and it is no surprise that these Dodgers and Padres in Game 7 of a 7-game regular season series over the course of a couple weeks, that they were not happy with each other. And yes, Jake, that is going to be our opener.
Things got ugly, messy, frantic, manic last night in Chavez Ravine as the beanball wars exploded at Dodgers Stadium. And it was a bizarre one for a number of reasons. The Padres were pissed because Fernando Tatis Jr. had gotten hit, I believe, two times in the series before last night. The Dodgers had won the first three games of this set, going for the mop on Thursday night against the Padres. Padres run out to a commanding 5-0 lead. Tatis gets plunked late in the game by a gentleman I'd never seen in my life, Jack Little, pitcher for the Dodgers. And the bench is clear. Dave Roberts, Dodgers manager, Mike Schilt, Padres manager, kind of do the I'm rubbing my chest against your chest and not using my arms to fight you thing that baseball men very much love to do. Next inning, Ohtani gets hit. He says, everyone stay in the dugout. Everything's fine. I'm Shohei Ohtani. I am impenetrable. I think it feels like once a year we need to do this and discuss the ethics and morality of beanball wars. We are generally out on this, but this one was fascinating for a number of reasons.
Yeah, and I think that the two angles we really need to focus on here, one is, well, as you mentioned, what we kind of have to do every season, which is when teams get involved in these sorts of situations, we as the neutral observers are left to parse and distinguish, okay, why would that one have been intentional? Was this retaliation for this? Was this pitcher, Jack Little, making his major league debut, was he being sent up there to throw at Tatis on purpose? Or was he just nervous and accidentally threw a fastball inside and hit one of their best players? And then you'd have Robert Suarez throwing 100 miles an hour at Ohtani's back. He hasn't hit a batter in 3 years. That sure seems like it was a little bit more intentional, but you don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it got away from him. Who's to say? What is different about this situation, and particularly the benches clearing incident, and what I think I want to dig into here, because it's easy to see the headlines, benches clear, bad blood, these rivals, they really hate each other. This specific sequence of events, and particularly how the teams and the two sides interacted, really seem to be a lot about the managers. Oftentimes when the bench is clear, you see players going at players or managers going at players yelling at so-and-so. This just seemed to be the managers being really upset with each other. And when we talk about these teams not liking each other, it is not that simple because, you know, Mookie Betts is just having Jackson Merrill on his podcast. A lot of these guys are friends. But in this case, it does seem like we've reached a point where Mike Schilt and Dave Roberts have a very clear disagreement about how all of this has gone.
Tanner Scott, Dodgers reliever, was just on the Padres 25 minutes ago. And you're right that the bad blood stems from the managers. And we've talked a little bit about how Yankees Red Sox has felt subdued in recent years and how I think that has something to do with Alex Cora and Aaron Boone having a relationship. And so the beef can get squashed before it bubbles out on the diamond. This is the opposite of that, where Roberts and Schilt are assuming the worst intent from the other side. And when you assume bad intent, that is how you get situations like what happened last night, where everyone is squaring up and screaming at each other. And I think that in the heat of the moment, I think it is understandable that Fernando Tatis, having gotten plunked three times already or two times already in the series, is frustrated about getting hit again. And I think the Dodgers should understand that frustration. And I think the same thing is clear when Ohtani gets hit. These are just angry baseball dudes on the diamond yelling at one another in the heat of the moment. What does it mean moving forward? Well, if you look at what Manny Machado said yesterday, quote, they need to set a little candle up for Tati tomorrow and hope that everything comes back negative. What does it mean moving forward, Jordan?
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, okay, and what if his hand is broken? Then what? Are we just going to keep throwing at the Dodgers' best players until they break their hand? This is what is so unpleasant about these situations, on top of on the very basic level of all of us left to hold our breath and hope that our best players, whether it's our favorite team or not, are not going to get injured in a very serious way. But trying to parse and dig through and be like, okay, could that have been intentional? Why was that? It's not really fun to talk about because it's impossible. And Mike Schultz said this after the game. He's like, only they know. Like, he was asked, do you think it was intentional that they threw at Tatis? And to be clear, this was the third time he was hit. And when we say the series, I believe he was hit once during the series in San Diego, and then he was hit once earlier in this series, and then now this third time. But it all feels compressed because it's over a small amount of time. And Schultz says, he's like, you know, only a couple people know whether it was actually intentional. But when you get to this point and this many people are getting hit, enough is enough. And Schultz says, well, my teams never get into these altercations because we never throw people on purpose. And then he says, but, you know, eventually you kind of have to stand up for someone. And that's when you get into the mess of like, okay, did Mike Schultz, after he got ejected from this game, somehow communicate to the dugout that Robert Suarez, who, by the way, wasn't even supposed to be in the game because they were up 5-0 and Sean Reynolds couldn't throw strikes to start the inning, so they had to bring in Robert Suarez to close this game out. Did they say, hey, Robert Suarez, you gotta hit Ohtani, you gotta do this? Or was Robert Suarez being a teammate? And did he want to take it upon himself because he cares about Fernando Tatis and he wants to throw at Ohtani? That's possible too. That doesn't make it any better who is making the decision to throw at people. But because there's so much nuance in all these situations, it's just exhausting to try and parse through these things, because the reality is we aren't ever going to know which ones exactly were intentional and which one weren't. And that's why I don't like talking about this whenever it happens over and over.
And each fan base, each team thinks that their own team is infallible and blameless. And so you end up with two mountains of morality screaming at the other, and we just end up here. And generally what will happen is it all just dies down and it simmers out, and then you forget about it, and then the next time, you know, these teams play, they run the video back, and usually everything's all right. Padres Dodgers, I'm not totally sure if it will die down in that same way, just because they're probably both going to be in the mix the next time they play each other. And as long as, oh God, you know, I'm going to light a candle here. I got a candle right here. I'm going to light a candle here that Tatis is okay. Because you know what, Jordan? I don't want to talk about this again. It's that freaking simple, but we felt like we had to because it was the story of the night last night. Now, the Dodgers did take 3 out of 4 in this series against the Padres to kind of open up a little bit of room between them and their division rivals in the NL West. The Dodgers now lead the division by 3.5 games, which that's over the Giants, and there are 5 games up on the Padres, which I believe has to kind of be their largest margin over San Diego in quite some time. We are finally starting to see the Dodgers, who have the best record in the National League right now as we're talking, just starting to pull away a little bit in the National League.
Yeah, I mean, they showed well in this stretch, right? They finally played the Giants. They finally played the Padres, and look at them now. They're right back on top. They've given themselves some cushion. They got the absolute mess of a Nationals team coming to town this weekend, so maybe they can grab a few more wins. But yeah, we're not going to see the Dodgers and Padres play again until August, and that's going to be the same situation where they play two series over a very short span. But we'll see where the standings sit at that point. We know the Giants are still certainly trying to make things interesting. The Diamondbacks still remain a little bit less relevant at this point, but we'll at least keep an eye on them. They have the talent to remain in the mix. But as always with the Dodgers, just when you think they're we were like, oh, there they are. Oh, only one game lead. Oh, this is the chance. They could, when we talk in a few days, they could be in third place. And that's like, no, that's not what happens with them. They find a way pretty much every time. And I will just say the last thing on just all the stuff from last night that was so funny. The two things were for Teoscar Hernandez just basically putting his arm around Mike Schilt and being like, hey, man, it's all going to be okay. And Schilt, you know, Teoscar's smile so contagious that Schilt is even kind of smiling and laughing like, yeah, I know, dude, but I'm just really not happy with your manager. And then Ohtani just wearing 100 on the back and then basically telling his dugout, like, guys, we're not doing this anymore. Like, sure, fine. They hit me. That's fine. He's like walking towards the Padres dugout, just like smiling and giggling. And Jose Iglesias is giggling back. And it's, again, it's a reminder that these are all very specific segmented situations involved with very individuals, and unfortunately in this case the players are the pawns and the manager seems to be the ones that are having the biggest issues. But the Dodgers are you know, eternally entertaining, and the Padres I know is a frustrating few weeks for them, as they probably wish they had kind of gained a little bit more ground.
So you remember a couple of weeks ago when the Dodgers rolled in to Queens to play the Mets, and we said they have 26 straight games coming up against teams above 500. It was, I believe, 7 against the Mets, 3 against the Yankees, a bunch against the Padres, the Giants, the Cardinals were mixed in there, the Guardians, when I hung out with you, which feels like 3 years ago. And that stretch is now over. That 26-game stretch is now over, and the Dodgers went 15-11. That is tied for the fourth most wins in baseball over that span. And I think it's pretty fair to say that all things considered, this run was a success for the Los Angeles Dodgers. They have made it through this gauntlet in the schedule, and I think they are in a more comfortable position today than they were when it began. And they had a lineup, I think it was last night, their starting lineup was just exactly what the Dodgers lineup is supposed to look like.
Yeah, well, in terms of the production, because I thought the Dodgers lineup last night was actually different than we've seen. And that is kind of, this is something that we started to see way back in Cleveland, which is like, I know Conforto homered that series, but it was like, is Conforto losing his playing time? And does Will Smith need to be batting third? I believe last night was the first game that Will Smith started against a right-handed pitcher batting third. Because, you know, we're so used to having the Ohtani, Betts, Freeman at the top of the lineup, but Will Smith has been so good that they finally decided to move him up. Again, I know they lost that game, and I know Will Smith got pinch hit for, and they, you know, probably could have used him at the end of the game when rookie Dalton Marshall was up. I know he got screwed by Marvin Hudson. I know all those things are true. But no, I hear what you're saying. I think that, and in general, to your point, like for them to be able to go comfortably above 500 over this stretch, and now you look ahead and you've got Nats, Rockies, Royals, White Sox coming up. Okay, like that's your gift here, is that now you can, you know, probably cruise a little bit easier, and you got Ohtani back, which is exciting. Maybe you have some of your other pitchers closer to coming back, even if Roki is not one of them. I think that they definitely have to feel like they're in a pretty good spot.
Two more Dodgers things before we take a break. One, the Dodgers bought the Lakers. Does this mean that baseball is more important than basketball forever for the rest of time? Duh, absolutely no. Here's the deal. We don't know what kind of impact this is going to have moving forward. It is relevant because it is the Dodgers being successful and well-run enough from an ownership perspective that the leadership group feels like it can diversify or expand its reach and purchase the Lakers. If I'm a Lakers fan, I am amped about this. The Dodgers have been the most consistent franchise in baseball since this ownership group bought the club, I believe in 2012 or 2013. And the Lakers, to my understanding, have been a bit of a disorganized mess at times. Now, look, we can have a conversation about ownership in sports and whether you want teams to be owned by these enormous private equity groups or by, you know, a family that discusses who they're signing at Thanksgiving dinner. But I think that in this specific case, the Walter and Co. group is very confident and will make the Lakers a better run franchise. Now, how the financial advantage of this ownership group manifests in basketball, where the salary cap is a lot more restrictive and the aprons restrict you from doing various transactions, I can't speak to that. There are many places here at Yahoo that can better than us, but I do think that we have a unique understanding of the ownership group here and believe that this is a good thing.
Yeah, and right, we'll leave it to the basketball pods to discuss exactly what this could empower the Lakers to do that they couldn't do before. But in this case, just in the, you know, oftentimes when teams get bought by rich people, the fans are like, you know, maybe you're saying bye to an owner that sucked and you're just excited, but you also don't know what to expect. But in this case, it's like the easiest thing to get excited for ever. If you're a Lakers fan and a Dodgers fan, you're like, yeah, that's going pretty well over there. So I'm pretty sure this is going to go pretty well over here, even if it's, you know, different restrictions and whatnot. And yeah, I think it's just, yet another. And I mean, if anything, not that these teams didn't have the occasional collab, I'm sure we'll, you know, maybe see Shohei at a few more Lakers games. Maybe we'll see a few more. There's all kinds of opportunities here, but it's probably also doesn't hurt that, you know, Luka Doncic just fell in their lap and they can, you know, buy the team that even once LeBron retires has Luka for the next however many years. So again, we're going to leave it to the basketball pods, but this feels like good news for Lakers fans.
We better not get the White Sox Bulls style City Connect uniforms with the Dodgers and the Lakers. I will be furious if the Dodgers are playing in purple and yellow. But boy, those would suck.
Yeah, I kind of want to go the other way. I think we should have the Lakers playing in baseball pants. Have Luka wearing a baseball jersey and baseball pants and, you know, nice cleats. Good setup. Yeah, probably cleats. A terrible idea. Anyway.
Cleats?
Cleats, yeah. We'll do cleats. What's worse for basketball? Probably cleats. That seems like a terrible idea for everybody involved. Anyway, yes, Dodgers by the Lakers. What a surprise. Mark Walter is a rich, extremely rich person. Congratulations to him.
The other thing that happened with the Dodgers yesterday is that they told Ice to buzz off. If you don't live in, unless you live, you know, underneath a rock, you are aware that there have been protests in Los Angeles over the last couple of weeks regarding the Trump administration's utilization of ICE to round up immigrants, citizens, etc. We are not necessarily qualified to talk about this in an in-depth manner. We know what's going on. It is disturbing. It is disheartening. It sucks. But the Dodgers, who I would refer to as one of the most important institutions in the city of LA, had remained relatively quiet on the matter up until yesterday. Dave Roberts had been asked about it. He said, kind of what I said before, I don't know enough about this. I think then Kike Hernandez had a post about it where he said that LA is a city of immigrants, and he believes that what ICE has been doing in LA is a bad thing and is horrible, et cetera, et cetera. Yesterday, it came out that the Dodgers were planning to make a more public statement and implement some sort of programming that protects immigrants in the city. That news kind of filters out. And then the next thing we know, ICE is at Dodger Stadium. Unmarked vans, the types of which that have been used to round up people in other places in the city, just appear in the expansive Dodger Stadium parking lot complex, and it turns into a whole thing. The Dodgers deny ICE access to the parking lot, and eventually those vans turn around. Unfortunately, so let's just say, feels to me zero coincidence that ICE shows up on the exact day the Dodgers are set to announce support for immigrants in Los Angeles. Like that, maybe it was a coincidence. I feel skeptical. And then Stan Kasten, who is the team president of the Dodgers, says we're going to press pause on announcing what we were going to do, which is unfortunate and kind of seems like this is exactly what ICE wanted. This is all to say, generally good on the Dodgers for taking something resembling a stand here. I don't think it is enough, and I think they will do more moving forward. But it is important, I think, that the Dodgers recognize their importance as an institution in the city. because when they have the parade and they win the World Series and they are celebrating themselves as important to the cultural fabric of this particular place, that has to have two sides. It can't just be reveling in the victory of it all and selling hats that have L's and A's on them. It's also taking a stand when it matters. And I think the Dodgers are a little late to the party here in this regard when it comes to what ICE has been doing in Los Angeles. I am hopeful moving forward that whatever they were sent to announce will be announced and it will be a positive step in the right direction.
Yeah, I echo all those sentiments. I mean, there's obviously a lot of horrific and discouraging things happening around the country and the world right now that we, of course, don't talk about much of on this baseball podcast. But when it's no surprise, we've covered a few examples of it already, but it's not a shock that we are arrived at a point where our government is impacting the sport we cover and literally showing up at the door of, you know, the most or one of the most important teams and forcing them to respond in this way. And I think the everything you just said, I'm with. But again, the fact that the Dodgers, right, like they, it was a choice for them to point, not just to deny them, but to put out a statement and say, this is what happened. We denied them. That is a very, you know, intentional thing that carries weight to some degree. But this is, unfortunately, because this is the time we're living in, this is very much a developing thing. And we are going to have to keep monitoring this because it's here we are. This is going to start impacting every part of our lives. And this is a small and obviously troubling example of that.
Well, it's also baseball, a sport that is made up by like 35% Latin American immigrants who are living in America. And I think that means that the league and the Dodgers organization has an even higher responsibility than other sports in other places to participate in this and to stand up to what has been going on in Los Angeles. All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll talk about the Braves sweeping the Mets and how the NL East is a weird place to be right now. We'll talk in a second. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. A little bit of standings movement over the National League East, where the Atlanta Braves swept the Nueva York Mets this week, three straight games in Atlanta. The Mets are now on an L6. Braves, probably the high point vibes-wise of their season thus far. Now, it certainly helped that in this series, they had Spencer Schwellenbach, Chris Sale, and Spencer Strider lined up, all of whom pitched well. Strider last night in closing out the sweep looked the most like Spencer Strider that he has looked this year. The fastball was the fastest it's been in the first inning this season. It had more carry on it. He was throwing a ton of sliders. He was much better against left-handed hitters. We still haven't really seen him work in a third pitch a whole lot, but I would say this was a significant step forward for Spencer Strider, a significant step forward for the Braves, who, and maybe we should have really appreciated this more at the time, getting Ronald Acuna Jr. back has been really important. Heading into the season, one of the main narratives of the Braves was, what do Acuna and Strider look like when they get back? Because these two players coming back from significant injuries deserve a little bit of grace and a little bit of runway to return to the best version of themselves. In regards to Strider, we have seen that he has needed a bit of time to get back to the Spencer Strider we know and love, the one that racks up strikeouts by the dozen. Acuna, on the other hand, has not stopped at go. He has not collected $200. He is headed straight to putting pitchers in Monopoly jail.
So we talk about how Strider, as you mentioned, it took him a few starts. I mean, he was looking just, he was bad. I mean, sure, he was throwing kind of hard, but the results obviously weren't there. And when Acuña homers on the first pitch he sees of the season, you're like, oh my God, he's totally back. And he kept hitting and he kept slugging. But I will say there was a bit of an adjustment period in his contact rate. What was so amazing about Acuña when he, you know, won the MVP a couple years ago is that he just kind of stopped striking out. he had basically been striking out, you know, more than 20% of the time for most of his career. And then suddenly in 2023, his strikeout rate was in half. Now this year, if you look at his strikeout rate, you see it's about in line with his career line, not like 2023, he struck at 22%, but he was striking out a lot. For the first couple weeks, it was a lot of slug, but he was whiffing quite often. And then about a week and a half ago, he stopped doing that. And now he has one strikeout in his last, I think, 10 games or 8 games. And the slug is still there. And now he's starting to draw walks again. And all the underlying stuff is unbelievable. And it's just like, I mean, he reached 100 plate appearances for the season last night. And he's got a 225 WRC plus, which is the same as Aaron Judge. So I don't know, like, how high Acuña is going to be able to climb on the NL MVP when you start your season as late as you do. But he's just immediately been one of the best hitters in the league, which we've seen before, and now is just a huge deal if the Braves have that again.
Ronald Acuña Jr. is ranked where in Fangraph's WAR for outfielders in baseball? Where do you think he ranks? He has played in 24 baseball games this year. Where does he rank amongst all outfielders in wins above replacement on Fangraphs? What is your guess?
Again, knowing that he has, as I just said, a 225 WRC plus, knowing that he's playing right field, I don't know what his defensive metrics have been. I don't really know how he's looked out there. I'm going to guess like 10th.
16th. Okay, he is 16th. He has produced 1.9 wins above replacement, which is tied with Juan Soto, okay? With Juan Soto. Now, they get to their value in different ways. Juan Soto has been a lot better recently. But per Fangraphs, Ronald Acuña in 24 games has been just as valuable as Juan Soto has been in 74. Acuña is ahead of Jung-Hoo Lee. He is ahead of Cody Bellinger. He is ahead of Javier Baez. He is ahead of Trent Grisham. He is incredible. He is sensational. He will only continue rocketing up this leaderboard as he collects more and more playing time. He absolutely should be at the All-Star game in Atlanta. I think given how well he has played, he will be. He deserves to be. He is one of the premier stars of the sport. The Braves and our sport are significantly better now that Ronald is healthy. And it changes the outlook of the Braves for the rest of the season. Like, yes, it has been a really horrendous first couple of months for the Atlanta Braves, underwhelming, well below their standards. Yes, they are still 5.5 back in the wild card. Yes, they are at 34-39. But Jordan, let me ask you this question. The teams that are ahead of the Braves in the wild card race, I'm going to say a name of a team. You're going to tell me if you trust that team more or less than the Braves. Arizona Diamondbacks or the Atlanta Braves. Who you got? Make the playoffs.
Braves.
Cincinnati Reds.
Braves.
St. Louis Cardinals.
Ooh, swept the White Sox. Braves.
Milwaukee Brewers.
Braves barely.
Okay. And then you get Padres, Giants, Phillies are the teams in the spot. So my point is the Atlanta Braves are still 5.5 back, but I feel like they will carve that gap down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, vibes and just what this team looks like. It took, you know, 70 games, 75 games, but now I feel like I'm watching the Braves. And it's possible that the hole that they have dug themselves in the wild card, or at the very least in the NL East, where they are still an astonishing 10 games back, is too deep for them to have any chance of winning the division. But this is it. This was the first real stretch where it was like, oh yeah, that's the team we thought was maybe the second best in baseball. I mean, we were all saying that, right? Coming into this, I think a lot of us were when we were projecting, oh, what once they get Strider and Acuña back, and we know they start 0-7 and so many other things are going wrong. And we said, no, this team just sucks. Who cares? Acuña and Strider can't save them. And we know there are other things going right, like Schwellenbach, like Sale, like some of their other hitters that are helping them get back into the mix here. But it is also a reminder of what Acuña and Strider can do when they are cooking. And that is very, very, very compelling. But one of the Braves thing that I want to make sure we mention before we open it up to the rest of the National League East is a major league debut that is coming on Friday. A right-handed pitcher by the name of Didier Fuentes. This child turned 20 years old a couple of days ago. He was born on June 17th, 2005. Yes, that's what that means. He is the first player born in 2005 to reach the major leagues. Of course, we have only two 2004 babies in the big leagues. That's Jackson Churio and Roman Anthony. But where the heck did this come from? Because a lot of people had never heard of Didier Fuentes before yesterday, and that's totally valid. He was one hell of a pop-up prospect last year, a Colombian right-hander who is not especially physical, but has a very, very special fastball and very advanced command. And that fastball and that command and that kind of aptitude has enabled a team like Atlanta, who is, as we know, very aggressive with their promotions and with their pitchers in particular. We saw a version of this a couple years ago with AJ Smith-Shawver. This is an even more out of nowhere ascent. And now you have a guy that's coming up to make his major league debut at age 20. Only Julio Urias, Felix Hernandez, and Edwin Jackson younger than Fuentes at the time of their major league debut as a starting pitcher. That is absolutely astounding. Now, just to be clear, this is not replacing anybody in the Braves rotation right now. Everyone is healthy and pitching well. That's Schwellenbach, that's Strider, that's Sale. That is Bryce Elder, and then it is Grant Holmes, of course, who is also still pitching quite well. But they wanted to give all those guys kind of an extra day of rest, so we're going to have Fuentes starting against the Marlins on Friday. So just an amazing ascent. I am, again, excited to know more. I don't know how much we should really expect from him to be in the big leagues after Friday, but it is a cool story. Anytime you can get to the big leagues that quickly, it is truly, truly remarkable.
First Didier in MLB history. And Jordan, I do believe it is Didier and not Didier.
Okay. I think it's somewhere in between. I mean, he's not French. He's Colombian. I think it's something close.
Well, we'll see. I believe we should refer to him as Didier Fuentes.
Yeah. So we'll get that pronunciation on Friday. So, but yes, he is was on no top 100 list coming into the year. No, but he's like very deep on the Braves list. And now here he is, age 20 in the big leagues.
How good does Didier Fuentes need to be to surpass Didier Drogba on the most famous Didier athlete list?
So good. Isn't Drogba one of the more successful soccer players of the past 20, 30 years? He was like one of the first soccer players I like knew to be like cool and in his prime when he was on Chelsea. And I was like, what's the sport on the doing? Oh, Drogba, this guy seems cool. So I don't know. But anyway, Fuentes, I'm very curious to see what that major league debut looks like. And yes, the Braves are going to Miami this weekend and then more Mets games next week, four-game series in Queens. So lot to dig into with the NL East. Anything else you want to cover in this division?
Well, they have four in Queens, and then they have three at home against the Phillies. So there are 10 straight games here against the NL East for the Braves. As far as the Mets go, remember how worried we were about Juan Soto? I don't, because Jake and Jordan were not worried. He did look out of sorts. That remains true, right? Juan Soto was not Juan Soto for a significant stretch of the season. He now has an 1101 OPS in June. He got his 1,000th career hit last night, which is a great reminder that like he probably won't get to 3,000 hits because he walks too much. But he totally could because he's Juan Soto and he debuted when he was 7 and is going to be under contract for 15 more years. Juan Soto is sensational. I think the Mets are having just a bit of return to equilibrium with their pitching staff. I think what this group has done with its pitching is real and does deserve a lot of credit. But at the same time, when you're rolling out Paul Blackburn and like that, and Clay Holmes is starting to show a little bit that the transition from the bullpen to the rotation is going to hurt as the season goes on, right? Like he's not used to this amount of bulk. I'm not concerned. I'm not worried. I do think the Mets really need to get Montas and or Manaea back. and that will kind of provide the boost that this rotation is looking for. However, things will not get any easier for the Mets as they head to Philly this weekend, and they will have Zach Wheeler tonight on the mound at Citizens Bank Park. Elsewhere in NL East gobbledygook, the Phillies just took care of the Marlins down in Miami. Kyle Schwarber with a couple more home runs. God, he is such a delight. He fires me up. We'll talk a little bit more about the Nick Castellanos situation later. Don't you worry. The Washington Nationals, however, heading into yesterday, were carrying in their pocket an L11, which looks like three ones if you lowercase the L. And thankfully for them, James Wood walked off the Rockies to avoid a mop at the hands of the Rockies. It is James Wood's 20th homer of the season, his second of that game. And as much of a mess as the Nats are, James Wood, I think it's fair to say, single-handedly, makes the Juan Soto trade palatable. The Nats have gotten a lot of credit for how they have handled that trade and who they got back. And I think, like, it was what? It was 2.5 years left of Juan Soto or six of James Wood?
Yeah. And here's the thing. That's the thing. James Wood is at the point now where he's single-handedly carrying that deal. And that's, if you ignore CJ Abrams and Mackenzie Gore, good baseball players. But I think what James Wood is doing right now is kind of what I thought he would do in 3 years. And he's just kind of like already doing it. And so it seemed like this would take more time to figure out. I think that is what is so astonishing about what he is doing right now. And I am so grateful to the Rockies for pitching to him for some reason. More on that later. But James Wood this week is doing his best to, he's certainly keeping the Nationals watchable, but he is one of the best players in the league. He is one of the most terrifying hitters in the league. The kinds of things he can do offensively are very different. And that is why he was, the most important player coming into the season. And as much as we think Dylan Cruz is going to be a good big leaguer, and I hope he still is, James Wood is a completely different category of impact talent, and I think we're really starting to see that. That said, is he saving this Nationals season? No. This was only the second series. Sure, you avoided getting mopped by the Rockies at home. You still lost the series to the Rockies, and you're only the second team that did that this season, right? Joining the Marlins. And so, and I mentioned the Marlins too, right? Because the Nationals, remember when we did our standings draft game, right? The Nationals in fourth place for the last few years, or at least the last 2 years, right? Since, of course, the Marlins decided to start tanking, felt like Nationals in fourth place. I mean, that's lock of all locks. But now here we are, and they are dangerously close to the Marlins. And when you consider the amount of talent that the Nationals do have, that is really embarrassing and says a lot about whether, again, I know Davey Martinez, whether it is the coaches, whether it is the players, whether it is the front office. So I don't care how we got there. This team can't be this bad.
It's a results-based business. And we had a whole story this week where Davey Martinez was asked if any of the lack of development at the big league level falls on the coaching staff. And he said, it's never the coaches. And then people were like, okay, well then what is it? Is it the players? And he was like, it's not the players either. And it's, well, okay, you can't suck for this long. This is a results-based business. And I don't think that Davey Martinez and GM Mike Rizzo have delivered the results. What they are going to do, what they have done and will do forever, is say, we won the 2019 World Series, so you have to trust us. We know what we're doing. And I think that that is fair to a certain extent, that the results have been there in the past. Do I think that Mike Rizzo is capable of building a sustainable contender right now with this Nats team? No, I don't. I think he can identify high-end talent, and I think the Juan Soto trade is a massive win, a win for which he deserves a whole lot of credit. That is a truth in a bucket. Here is another truth in another bucket. I don't think he can supplement what they have right now to turn the Nats into a consistent contender moving forward. Davey Martinez and his coaching staff? Do I think that they can develop players at the big league level to get the most out of them? That I'm a little bit more TBD on, just because I want to see more runway for players like Hassel and Cruz to make that assessment. I think what's happened with Mackenzie Gore is awesome and a huge win and notable. I have zero faith in K-Bear Ruiz. As you know, I'm the lowest in the room on that guy as a player. I think that the general consternation about the Nationals right now is legitimate. This year, given the enormous success of James Wood, they should be closer in the standings. There should be a conversation right now about the Nats at the deadline. Should this team be going for it? Should they be selling? Like, that is what it should be. Not, oh my God, we just lost 11 games in a row, including three of the Rockies. This season has been a failure. Full stop. Simple as. I'm curious your thoughts on it, Jordan.
Yeah, I think that that's all fair. And as you mentioned, like, Davey either threw Mike Rizzo, who defends him and says, like, I'm not thinking of firing him. He won the World Series. None of these other guys that got fired recently have won anything, and but Davey has. It's like, okay, that's true. And I do think that that trade that he made for Juan Soto is, of course, one of the great trades that we've ever seen, and they are going to continue to benefit from it. But that should be all the more reason that Rizzo should be taking more heat. Because sure, you could say, oh my God, if they hadn't done that, they would be so bad. But it's like, you did that well, and you still suck. You're still going backwards. That's even more of an indictment. Like, great, I'm so glad you have these core pieces, but the fact that you can't build around them, you should be getting all the same, even more, you know, hate than Pittsburgh and the teams that have like the one pillar, you know, like Paul Skeens and no money. This also comes back to ownership too, right? And so that's the other part of it too, is that clearly the learners are more okay with just kind of letting this go on and on and on. And that's, I think, just disappointing, frankly. And I think that that is why Nats fans are kind of tired of this, because there are pieces in place on both sides of the ball that a lot of teams are very envious of. And you should be making the most of that. I know it's a tough division. It's not like we were expecting them to make the postseason this year. But you certainly shouldn't be going backwards. I think there is absolutely no denying that. Jake, let's take a break. When we return, let's return to Omaha, Nebraska, check in on the College World Series, and then give you the good, the bad, the ugly. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. For those of you watching on YouTube, you can see that I'm putting my Omaha hat on, literally. I just got back from Nebraska yesterday from the College World Series, which has two teams left in it. The finals will begin Saturday evening. Coastal Carolina Chanticleers, not Chanticleers, Chanticleers, against the LSU Tigers. And we'll preview that finals in a quick second, but we need to talk about how we got there first. The semifinal game between LSU and Arkansas, which I was in the building for, was one of the most remarkable baseball games that I have really ever seen. Arkansas needing a win in that game to stave off elimination. There would have been one more game between LSU and Arkansas to reach the finals. Arkansas is winning 5-3 in the ninth inning of a topsy-turvy back-and-forth affair. One out, error, walk, weird fielder's choice, line drive that you've probably seen off of left fielder Charles Davalon's shoulder, ball squirts away, tie game, pitching change, LSU walks it off. Complete heartbreak, total, just debilitating, disheartening loss for the Razorbacks. And the context here for this team is important. Arkansas is probably the most accomplished program in college baseball history to have never won a College World Series. They're right up there with UNC and Florida State. In that regard, Arkansas in 2018 was one out away from winning the College World Series. There was a pop-up down the right field line that fell in what is now known as the Arkansas Triangle between the first baseman, second baseman, and right fielder. Oregon State ended up coming back to win that game and then won Game 3. And this had a similar energy to it. Jordan, when heartbreaking losses like this, which had a Yankees World Series Game 5 fifth inning energy to it, when this happens at the college level, it carries a little bit more heartbreak to it, right?
So much, so much more. And I think, yeah, the Yankees fifth inning is exactly what it's like, because from a just series of unfortunate events in the same inning, you know, it's not just that they lost the game, is that all of those things happened in the same inning was so hard. But to your point, the double context of Arkansas's history, Arkansas, because the other part is you say, oh, well, Yankees fifth inning, that was in the World Series. This wasn't even in the finals. If Arkansas wins this game, they have to play LSU again, and then they have to beat this amazing Coastal team that's won 26 games in a row. Oh, they weren't guaranteed to win at all. And that's true. It was a long road for them from here. But Arkansas was still, I think, pretty clearly the most talented team, and they could have done it. They could have kept going, and this felt like the year for them. But back to your main point, which is why it is so much harder to watch when this happens in college. Well, the obvious thing is that these are younger human beings who, of course, are not as, you know, used to these levels of pressures and the weight and the stakes and all these things. But it's also as simple as, for a lot of those guys, including Charles Davalon, who is going to very deservingly be a, you know, first top two round draft pick coming up next month. That's it. That was the last college baseball game that he played in. While the Yankees, of course, were heartbroken and cared a lot and it really hurt, and they changed their team a lot. But a lot of those key guys get to come back and try again, and they make a lot of money doing it, and they're professionals and they're adults. But when you feel like you are responsible for your school falling short, and then knowing that you have to move on because that's just kind of how this works, and in some cases, there's also just seniors, right? I mean, that's another thing that, of course, we see all the time at like the Division III level, when we see heartbreaking losses all the time. And you know that like that's truly the end of their actual baseball career. Like that is really where it hurts. Charles Davalon, we think, is going to be a great player, going to be a big leaguer, but it's still just so painful when you understand what seasons like this mean to programs like Arkansas.
And the game ends. And I go down onto the field on the Arkansas side and just tried to soak up a little bit of that energy. And, you know, we see Davalon in tears. I think that kind of undersells it a little bit. I think he was really crying as much as I've ever seen an athlete cry. And I think that that's okay. You know, if you listen to this podcast, that Jake and Jordan are pro crying in baseball. He was inconsolable. He went up to his coach, the head coach of Arkansas, Dave Van Horn, and said, "I'm sorry," right? And Dave Van Horn said, "You had nothing to apologize for. We wouldn't be here without you," and that is true. The pain of this goes away in time, and the good stuff is what he will remember and what Vahiva Aloy will remember, who had a weird play on a ball in that inning. And, you know, I understand it is a slightly different context and stakes, but, you know, we've talked about how my college career ended, Jordan, which is, I crumbled and peed my pants in a regional tie game in the bottom of the 10th inning and hit the first guy I faced on the first pitch I threw, and then hit the second guy on the first pitch I threw him, and I walked off the mound and was a mess, and I never threw a competitive pitch again in my life. And like, at the time, that sucks, and it still sucks now, but as it fades away, you remember the good stuff, right? Like, and the other stuff fades. Now, look, the stakes in Omaha on TV with a fan base where there's NIL money, I get that's different than little old Jake's D3 regional game. I understand. But I'm just trying to provide some context here that, like, in time, you remember the good stuff. And before we move on, I just want to kind of paint a picture of what I saw down there, something that I think really will stick with me forever. And I might end up writing about this. I might not. So I walked down to the dugout. And I am looking like down the first baseline, even with the dugout railing, okay? And on the first base dugout bench are most of the Arkansas players, and they're sitting there, you know, they're distraught. No one's talking. They're just kind of staring out into the distance at what could have been. And in front of them on the warning track dirt, the kids of Omaha are let out onto the field for Kids Run the Bases Night here at Charles Schwab Field. And so you have like 200 kids, like ages 6 to 10, you know, 2 to 12, whatever, running onto the field to go run the bases in front of the Arkansas waterworks. And the Arkansas players are kind of having to like weave their way through the line of kids to get back to the dugout. And you see the Arkansas guys looking out at these kids and looking out at their own past, right? At like the innocence of these kids running around on a baseball field and the kids on Arkansas that will never play again being reminded of what once was. And then behind the Arkansas guys, as I want you to like look at this out towards the first baseline, right? You have the kids on the dirt track, you have the Arkansas guys on the dugout, and then in the stands, you have all the Arkansas guys' parents waiting for them. And you see these three generations in a way of baseball participants, the parents who drove the players to every game and paid for travel ball and baseball pants and gear. And then you have the players who are caught in between their past and their future. And this image, it will stick with me forever. And then one of the kids running the bases, he's walking by the dugout and he just looks towards the bench. His kid was maybe 6 years old and he looks at them and he just goes, "Hey, you guys did good." And I just like, if you've ever played competitive sports at any level, you know that feeling of when it's over, right? When it's done. And like, I didn't cry because, you know, it would have been a little weird. And like, I don't know any of the Arkansas players personally, and I don't care about the university. It doesn't mean anything to me, right? But if you played at any level of any sport, it puts you in this position where like you feel this like half cry behind your eyes. It's like a little heavy. You feel bad for these kids. And I know that in that moment, if I had gotten a call from any of my college teammates in that exact moment, I just would have wept. I just would have been a puddle.
Yeah.
In that exact moment. And so that's just the story and image I wanted to share of the three generations of baseball in that moment. And for me, it was just so beautiful and indicative of why this sport and the never-ending cycle of it is wonderful. And one day, those Arkansas kids will be in the stands and their kids will be in the dugout and there'll be another group of kids going to run the bases on Kids Run the Bases Night after an elimination game in the College World Series.
Yeah, and man, I feel like we should just end the pod there, but we still have a lot of fun stuff left. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I know there are some people, as you kind of hinted at there, that were like not happy that this is what was happening and the timing of that. I think that's kind of fair that it's like, no, like how disrespectful, you should let these guys deal with it. But I think the picture you just painted is also perfect. It's entirely fitting that is kind of all overlapped in this weird sequence of baseball joy and sadness. I think that is a good way to paint the picture. Quickly, just before we go to Good, Bad, Ugly, like, I'm very excited for this national championship. One of the cool things about, you know, the College World Series when it works out this way is that they're fully rested. And, you know, these teams have been rolling, and that means we are going to get the best possible pitching matchups. We're going to get Cade Anderson, LSU lefty, who might be the first overall pick this year. He's not, you know, considered a generational, little life-changing talent like Paul Skenes, but my gosh, is he a good pitcher. And him, Anthony Ianson, who's another possible top three round pick, going for LSU presumably in game two. Kaysen Evans, you know, we'll see. They have a lot of arms they could choose from if it goes to a game three. And then Coastal's got real guys too. Cameron Flukey, who's a sophomore. He's going to be a draft guy for next year. Jacob Morrison, one of the most statistically dominant pitchers this year. A really, really big right-hander who's probably going to be around, you know, 3 to 5 this year pick. Riley Eichhoff, who's kind of more the consummate college starter. So Coastal hasn't lost since like early April. So I you know, picking against them feels foolish at this point. But if, 26 in a row, which is a record for, you know, biggest winning streak going into the College World Series finals, which no surprise there. So we'll see if they can get it done. And you know, there are a lot of fun storylines here. Coastal, of course, won in 2016 against Arizona, who was coached by Jay Johnson, who's now the LSU head coach. So a lot of fun narratives here, and it should be a great College World Series finals. Cool to have the LSU, you know, the powerhouse against, you know, a mid-major powerhouse. It should be a really, really good series. So we obviously encourage you to tune in. But all right, Jake, It's Friday. We've already talked a lot, but we still have more fun stuff left on this Friday edition, and that's because it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly.
All right, I will start off with my good. Yesterday, we mentioned this. James Wood, walk-off home run, two-run shot against the Rockies to win the game for the Nationals. But afterwards, Rockies manager Warren Schaefer is asked, like, hey, you had an open base and James Wood up as the winning run and you pitched to him? He already homered on the day and the other Nationals aren't very good. Why don't you walk him? And a lot of managers, and we've seen this before, will kind of go, they'll be like, oh, I don't know, you know, we thought it was the right idea. We trust our guy to go get the out. Warren Schaefer said, quote, that's on me. I think I can look myself in the mirror better if we're losing to Garcia. It's not like I don't trust Seth Halverson to get him, but I probably should have put him on. Yes, Warren Schaefer. Yes, admitting your mistake, saying sorry, that is good. I hate it when managers are not just like, yeah, you know what? I messed up. Saying that you messed up, just say you messed up. Say sorry, admit fault, and move forward. And I bet Rockies fans who have had very little to appreciate this season appreciate this blast of energy from their skipper.
Amen to that. Go, Rockies, go. My good this week comes courtesy of Colin Beasley, who covers the Pirates for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And I believe he was in Altoona covering a double-A game where the Richmond Flying Squirrels, the Giants' double-A affiliate, were in town. And the Giants' double-A affiliate bullpen posted a sign in their bullpen kind of directed at the fans asking for baseballs. And here's what the sign reads. It says, we cannot give you a ball. We just traded for Devers and he costs a lot of money. Foul balls, yes, we can hook you up. And then it says below it, this is kind of like words of wisdom. It's better to be seen, not heard. Be cool and we'll be cool back. This is just outstanding stuff all around. Thank you to Colin for this tremendous reporting. And the photo of it is great. The smirk from the Giants reliever in the back, who I'm not sure who it is great. And everything about this is awesome. We cannot afford to give you baseballs because we have to pay Rafael Devers. It is so funny and wonderful. This is just so, like, I feel like I haven't had enough of just like wholesome minor league content in my life. And this is,
yeah,
perfect. Perfect. Very good.
The reason I love this too is that the logic doesn't make sense for you and me, right? Because we know that the financial amount of giving a kid a ball like doesn't play, whatever, who cares? But as far as it goes for the kids who are screaming, this logic plays for an 11-year-old, right? You're like, oh, well, they just got, I can't afford to give me a ball. That's fine. Hey, buddy, did you get a ball? No, they can't afford it because of Devers.
It's so perfect. So, sorry, I don't have I actually do recognize some names here on this Flying Squirrels bullpen, but I will save people the time because then I'm just going to start naming people that nobody knows except for me. All right. From the good to the bad, what was bad for you this week, Jake?
Nick Castellanos was benched. He was sat after being pulled from a game against the Marlins. Castellanos reportedly snapped at his skipper, Rob Thompson. And then the next day, he was sat down and told, you don't start today. Snapping, I believe, his 236th game in a row, which was the longest streak in Phillies history since Pete Rose, and one of the longer streaks in baseball. And something that Nick Castellanos like really cared about and cares about. And I think that's why this was particularly an ouch for Castellanos. What made it even worse is, do you know where they were? Miami, where Castellanos is from. And I would imagine that there was a part of Nick saying, you did this in front of my people, my 305ers. That's even worse. The impetus of all of this is that Castellanos was pulled from a game for defense because Nick Castellanos is bad at defense. And the Phillies had Johan Rojas on the bench, who is maybe the best at defense, certainly on their team at outfield defense. And so pulling Castellanos, moving Brandon Marsh to a corner and putting Yoan Ross in center is something that 95% of managers would do. Now, Rob Thompson, to his credit, I guess, has been reluctant to do this. He has not pulled Castellanos late in games for defense, which is a, I would say, sign of respect to Castellanos as a veteran and maybe not the best move if you're trying to win baseball games all the time. But Castellanos did not appreciate it. And after the game, I believe the other day, this is via Charlotte Varnes over The Athletic, quote, "I told Dave to start giving me a packet with all my numbers so I can understand it. That way I know how to be competitive with it." This is what is silly. Nick Castellanos is bad at outfield defense. In fact, he is maybe, what, bottom five in the league at outfield defense if you go by outs above average. Now, the way that the Phillies are constructed, they need to play Castellanos in the outfield every day. They need to convince Nick Castellanos that he is good at defense, because if Nick Castellanos has to go play defense every day and thinks that he's bad at it, he's going to be even worse at it. And so you understand why it is important for the Phillies to pump up Casty's ego as a defender. That being said, Casty, it's not if... It's the question is not whether you are good at or bad at defense. It is whether you are better or worse than Yoan Rojas at defense, because that who is coming in for you at the end of games. I think all of the stuff about Devers being selfish and not playing a position, this fits into that bucket too, where like Castellanos as a vet should swallow his pride, understand his limitations, and let Yoan Rojas track balls down in the last two innings of the game. It is not an indictment of you as a person or as a hitter. It is merely a recognition that you are not the best outfield defender on your team. It is all weird. It is all bad. Do I think it matters for the Phillies long term? Not really. Do I think that Nick Castellanos will be on the Phillies next year? Talk about that later. This is just so freaking funny. That's all I have to say.
My bad this week is whatever the hell was going on in Detroit on Thursday. After a rainout, the Pirates and Tigers were supposed to play a doubleheader. Everyone was mad at the start of the day because Tarek Skubal and Paul Skenes weren't pitching in the same game. Yeah, that's disappointing. Whatever. Guys, we'll get it in the World Series. Okay? Relax. Okay, anyway. Why is this bad? That is not bad. I mean, it is bad, but it's not more bad than Dennis Santana, Pirates reliever, swinging at a fan. That's very, very bad. Seemed like the vibes were just terrible in Detroit yesterday. The Pirates ended up winning the second game. Tommy Pham, people were screaming at Tommy Pham. Tommy Pham got some fans thrown out. AJ Hinch got ejected. Nobody was having a good time in Detroit yesterday. And Dennis Santana swinging at a fan, that's just bad. That's bad. It's pretty bad. I don't think I have to explain this any further. And again, in situations like this, I'm sure that there are fans saying things that are completely not okay. And it's not like I am condoning that. But that doesn't make this reaction good. So it's bad.
You know how many big league players have not swung at fans? Most of them.
Yeah. Dennis Santana joins Anthony Rendon. Which is not a good group to be with. All right, let's go to Ugla. What you got for Ugla, Jake Mintz?
Pope, 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 Pope. The Pope is back. Knowing ball, it feels like we do this every week, and that's awesome. This should be in good. We have a video of the Pope getting a White Sox chant yelled at him at the Vatican, and it's two dudes filming this, and they're going, "White Sox. White Sox." And as the Pope strolls by on his Popemobile, he realizes the chant and starts chanting White Sox with them. I want to know who these two guys are. And I think that it's a weird thing to chant because they should be chanting Let's Go White Sox and not White Sox, White Sox, White Sox. That being said, the Pope recognizing them is just the best.
Yeah, I agree. This is super Ugla. I do now wonder if like that the rest of the world now finds out that he's a White Sox fan, even if they don't know that the White Sox, like don't know anything about the White Sox. Like if that's just one of his defining personality traits that like even random people from like Luxembourg are like White Sox, White Sox, like that would be great. And maybe that's what was happening here. Because to your point, like don't you say Let's Go White Sox? Isn't that like a more standard chant?
Yeah.
So maybe this was an example of people just knowing that he would respond to saying White Sox.
It wasn't like they were chanting, Vide sucks, Vide sucks, right? Like, the accent wasn't thick enough. But it did have an aspect of non-ball knower behind the chant, which is insulting to me because the Pope is indeed a ball knower.
My Ugla this week is the Ryan meetup at Coors Field. There is this group of people named Ryan who go around the world and meet up with each other and get as many Ryans as possible in the same place. It is one of the funniest things ever. They have organized to do this at Coors Field today, this Friday. And who is promoting it but our dear friend and former podcast guest, Ryan Spielborgs. And I was wondering, like, why the hell are we doing this at Coors Field other than Coors Field is a good place to have a good time, no matter what your name is? And it can't be, even though the news stories are not explicitly acknowledging this, it can't be an accident that it's the team with the most Ryans. Ryan Feltner, Ryan Ritter, Ryan Mollison, Ryan McMahon. I don't know if, I think only three of them are currently on the active roster, but it is still more than any other Major League team. I did all kinds of research into how many Ryans we've had in Major League history. Quickly, Jake, before we end the show, how many Ryans are currently, have played in Major League Baseball in 2025? How many do you think? I just named four of them.
I'll say 14.
27. 27. Wow. Ryans, including all-stars Ryan Helsley, Ryan McMahon, Ryan Pressly, of course, some other great Ryans. We got Ryan Braun in the past, Ryan Dempster, Ryan Howard, Ryan Klesko, Ryan Ludwig, Ryan Vogelsong, Ryan Zimmerman. Shouts out to the Ryans. There have been 123 Ryans in Major League history.
Why you always Ryan?
That is the good, the bad, the ugly. The weekend ahead, Jake, all kinds of fun stuff happening. We got Rafael Devers playing against the Red Sox. We got the Tigers going down to Tampa, where the Rays are maybe being sold. More on that next week. Nationals at Dodgers. That'll be interesting. PCA continues to dominate for the Cubs. They got the Mariners coming to town, and the Orioles head to the Bronx, where they will face the Yankees, who avoided getting mopped on Thursday, but still aren't playing very well.
Two more quick things. Christian Campbell sent down to AAA, which is unfortunate because it was kind of the whole impetus behind the Devers thing. But it's fine. Don't think too hard about it. And then Sammy Sosa coming back to Wrigley Field. He has, in my to my knowledge, not been at Wrigley Field for like 20 years. And this is going to be Sosa Fest today, this afternoon, at the friendly confines.
Okay. Very interested in that because he was at you know, Cubs Con, that was like a whole thing over the offseason, but I guess at Wrigley Field is a new thing. So we will keep an eye out for that. And we will be back next week to recap the weekend. Thank you to Andrew Hartz. Thank you to TJ Brassel. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for doing this podcast with me. Hopefully everyone has a wonderful weekend, and we will talk to you later this week. Bye-bye.